Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Lauren.
Mike.
Lauren, when you eventually quit Twitter, are you going to take all of your talents to Snap?
Oh, this is a loaded question because you're making the assumption that I'm quitting Twitter, but then you're asking about Snap. I would say Snap might not be my first platform of choice, but it's not a bad option after Twitter.
Do you feel as though your particular gifts at social media engagement don't translate to the platform?
I'm generally a little bit more pithy and clever with words than I am at like bunny ears. What about you? Are you going to quit Twitter and bring your talents to Snap?
I don't think so.
All right. That's it. That's today's show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I am Michael Calori. I'm a senior editor at Wired.
And I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
Today, we are talking about the biggest social media story of the week, the thing that everyone online is talking about, which is Snap, the company formerly known as Snapchat. You probably thought I was going to say Twitter.
I did.
And yes, the Twitter board and Elon Musk did reach an agreement this week for Musk to buy Twitter and take the company private. It's huge news in the Web 2.0 world and potentially marks the end of one era and the beginning of another. We talked about Twitter on last week's show, and we do have plans to talk about it again next week with a very special guest coming on the show, by the way. But there was also news out of Snap this week. And it's important to note that the company's main app, Snapchat, is actually bigger than Twitter. Snap also makes funky hardware. And Lauren, you had the chance to talk to the company's hardware folks and get some early looks at the latest Snap gadgetry this week. So please tell us, what did the Snap kids dream up at Coachella this time?
Yes, I think they did come up with this at Coachella like just a couple weeks ago. And they really expedited the hardware process. And here we are. Okay, so this week was Snap's annual partner summit, which they hosted just 1 year down in Los Angeles where Snap is based. And then the pandemic hit. So they've been hosting this virtually ever since. But it's their version of an app developers conference. It's where they typically make software announcements that are relevant to the people who build apps, or as Snap calls them, lenses for the Snapchat app and stuff like Snap's AR glasses. But sometimes, amongst all of the software announcements, there's a hardware nugget in there as well. And this year, it's a flying camera.
Get out.
Yes, also known as a drone. No. Don't call it a drone, et cetera, et cetera. It's called Pixie. That's spelled P-I-X-Y. And it's this small yellow plastic pancake, or maybe a waffle. I'll call it a waffle because I like waffles, that rests on the palm of your hand and it takes flight to take a photo or a video of you and your friends. Isn't this the thing you've always wanted, Mike?
I can only imagine. So it's a Snapchat drone. So it flies around and takes a picture of you. Does it just like fly up, take a picture, and then fly back down? Does it land on your hand?
Yeah, it takes these very short flights. I haven't personally used it yet. The briefing that I got, all the briefings that I got were virtual. So I don't know exactly how it works, but I've seen videos of it. So there are four modes that you can use. First, you wirelessly pair this Pixie drone to your Snap mobile app. Then you press a button on the drone to turn the drone on. And then there's this silver dial on the top that you can turn to one of the modes. And so, like, for example, it can zoom out from you and then take a photo of you and your friends and zoom back towards you, or it can orbit around you. Those are just two out of the four modes. And then you hold out your hand with your palm open, and supposedly it lands in the palm of your hand. It captures 12 megapixel photos, so pretty standard still photo capture. The video is a little bit low res. It's 2.7K resolution, so this is not super high def or 4K video. And then those media assets get wirelessly sent to the Snap apps. Then you have to go into the Snap app to like interact with them or use them. And then you can save them to your camera roll if you want to share them elsewhere. But the whole idea is it's bringing you back to the Snap app.
I see. How much does it cost?
There are going to be two options. There's a base pack that starts at $230. And then there's a bundled pack that costs $250, which comes, like, I think, with some more accessories. And then there are additional batteries that are available for $20. And you probably would want to buy some of the additional batteries, because when you're measuring the battery life on a product like this, it's so variable. It's not just like a phone. Of course, phones are very variable as well when it comes to battery life, depending on how people use them. But with this, it's being measured in flight bursts. Like, Snap is saying it can take 5 to 8 flights per charge, but a lot of that is going to depend on how long each flight is and also the movement that you are programming it to do. So something that requires like a big burst of energy, such as zooming out from you and zooming back, might actually suck up more power than some of the other modes. So it's all going to depend on how you use it, but you getting 5 uses out of it per charge, it's really not much. And like by uses, I don't mean like it's following you around for a half hour. I mean, it just like zooms out, takes a photo and zooms back.
That's actually a good point, because one of the great advancements in drone technology over the last few years has been all of the flight automation features, right? The ability for the camera to see you and follow you, or the ability for the camera to fly around your head without banging into a wall and to keep you centered in the frame. Does it have any of that stuff going on?
I don't think it's quite that advanced yet. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've seen some friends who are skiers, like much more accomplished skiers than I am. I'm thinking of my friend Viren in particular, where like I see some of the footage that he posts later on Instagram, and clearly it was shot with a drone, and the drone is like following him down a ski slope, and it's really, really cool. And I think we've reviewed Skydio's drones, and one of the primary features of that drone is that it does that, right? It's designed to actually follow you and track you for an extended period of time. Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's pretty cool stuff. And those, I think the drones we're describing too are a little bit more expensive and just high powered in general. I don't think this is designed for that. I think this is really designed for these little bursts of activity, these short interactions, and very much like social features. Like, you're with a group of friends, you're at Coachella, I'm just going to assume. And the thing, like, you're like, let's take a selfie, but there are 20 of us and no one has a 6-foot arm. And so let's send this thing off into the sky and I'll take this great photo of us and send it right back. And then also I could imagine some creators, quote unquote creators, video producers, influencers, that kind of thing, using this to get maybe an additional angle on something that they're shooting with another device.
So it seems like, you know, this is something that pretty much only like Snapchat devotees are going to be buying, because for $230, if you're looking to get a drone that can take your picture, there are other options if you spend just a little bit more money, something, you know, more high powered, something that can stay aloft more than, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. But it's kind of interesting to me to think that like this is obviously an experiment. It's just something that's like strange and kind of fun and sort of fits in with the company's branding. The company has a history of doing this, right? Like making devices that are kind of impractical and kind of expensive, but also just fun and sort of fit into the Snapchat aesthetic.
Yeah, that I would say that's exactly right. I mean, let me ask you a question, Mike. Have you ever purchased any of Snap's hardware?
No, because the thing that they made in the past is the glasses, the spectacles. Mm-hmm. And they don't necessarily fit me. I have a large head. So like they just look really small on me. And also I wear a prescription and I haven't bothered to put a prescription in Snap spectacles. So I put them on and I'm basically just like walking around blindly shooting things. So no, I have not purchased any of their hardware. I have seen it and held it and used it though.
Yeah, we had some of those spectacles floating around the office for a while too. I mean, I think you're right in that Snap's history of hardware is that it is largely weird and experimental. They have this area of the company called Snap Labs where they develop some of this. And when you ask Snap, like I had the chance to talk to co-founder and CTO Bobby Murphy earlier this week, they say that when they develop and design these products, they develop them with scale in mind. They want to reach as many people as possible. But even with that said, I think they do have a different approach with their hardware than they do with the software. I mean, just look at the spectacles, right? The first pair of those glasses were launched back in 2016. They were initially distributed only through this Snap branded pop-up vending machine called the Snapbot. I mean, eventually they became more widely available, but you could only get them if you like stumbled upon this vending machine in the middle of Coachella. I'm just going to keep referring to Coachella, but they were in like different places in LA. And I don't think there might've been one in like, do I remember one in like Joshua Tree? Anyway.
Yeah they were all over the coast. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And not many of those sold, right? And they didn't have any augmented reality. They were really just capturing videos and then eventually photos. Now they did release another version of these spectacles back in 2018, which our colleague Ariel Pardes and I literally took on a roller coaster. We both wore a pair of these Snapchat spectacles version 2 and pressed, you know, record on our frames as we were going down a very, very steep roller coaster. So that was a lot of fun. And then last year in 2021, Snap did finally roll out AR glasses, which to their credit came before any kind of Facebook or Apple AR glasses, but they're super clunky and they were only for app developers. They weren't for consumers and they too had a short battery life. So sometimes it just seems like Snap's end game with its hardware experiments are just how can we get people deeper into Snap, the app? How can we get people deeper into AR? It all comes back to their AR lenses and like selling people on those. And then there's like a little bit of also, and how can we beat Facebook to market, aka Meta, so that Facebook can inevitably copy them?
Yes, absolutely. So all of these hardware experiments, they do, we keep calling them experiments, and maybe that's, you know, a little bit derogatory, but at the same time, these are things that have been rather inaccessible, rather limited, and have not really stuck. You know, I can't remember ever seeing spectacles in the wild.
Right. And even the AR glasses, I think I've only seen them in the wild once, and it was at an AR specific conference that I went to last November. And it was a developer who was wearing them, and I was interviewing her on stage with Bobby Murphy from Snap. So it was a very specific scenario in which I saw those AR glasses.
It doesn't count. That's like spotting Google Glass at Google I/O.
That's right. It's like spotting like Google Glass at like Sergey's birthday party.
Okay, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Snap in the broader context of all the social media apps we use today.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click here. Stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click here.
And liftoff.
Click here. Every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about Snap's place in the social media landscape. We mentioned earlier that Snap is actually bigger than you probably imagine it is. It has more than 330 million active daily users. That makes it bigger than Twitter, which has somewhere around 215 million. So Lauren, please enlighten us. Who are these Snapchat users?
First of all, thank you for my promotion to post-collegiate field reporter on all of the Snapchat users, including myself. I think Snap users are probably my 13-year-old niece and all of her friends. But seriously, it's, you know, users tend to be young or youngish. The thing about Snap users, though, is that they are also very active. They don't just fire off a tweet or two or like post an Instagram photo and move on. In some cases, Snap users are messaging all day long. I've seen different numbers on this. In some cases, it's an average of like 34 messages per day. In other cases, it's as many as 100. And they supposedly, quote unquote, interact with an average of, you know, collectively 6 billion AR lenses per day, right? Which is Snap's special sauce. Like you apply this lens to your face and you send a photo of yourself. And this all happens really quickly. The app is really easy to use. And part of like the dark pattern or stickiness of the app is that people are encouraged to maintain these streaks, which just shows that like they've been keeping up their messaging. And so their streak number gets like longer and longer. And the thing about the content on Snap too, based on what I've observed, is that it can be really unpolished. It's less glossy and less curated than Instagram. In some ways, it's more like TikTok, though TikTok actually has some really great productions on it that are just made to look raw, but are actually very produced. A lot of people just use Snap by like just firing off a really off the cuff photo of themselves and like blasting it out to a bunch of friends and messages and not really, it just doesn't feel as like curated, I guess is the right word, as you might get from Instagram.
So what you're saying, and I've also observed this, is that it's primarily just a messaging app. Like we often think of, you know, social media as posting and broadcasting, but I think Snapchat's real strength is the one-to-one relationship between its users. Because if you open up the app and you look at the only thing that's there other than one-to-one messaging, which is discovery, it's a lot of just sort of lowest common denominator junk. You know, it's a lot of like tabloid style stuff, stunts, stupid human tricks, weird hacks, like beauty advice. It really reminds me of the types of things that you would see at like the bottom of a story on like a not very good blog, like that chum box where it's just sort of, you know, clickbait type stuff. There are publishers on there. I know the company recently allowed publishers to put their RSS feeds into Snapchat. So you can follow like the Washington Post, for example, and then basically just read one story a day from the Washington Post by tapping on a Snapchat feed inside the app. So it's like, unless you follow a lot of people and follow creators, there's not really a lot for you to engage with there. So it seems like building a friend network and interacting with those friends, that's their real strength, which is funny when you consider that the things that they have done with that have been copied elsewhere, right? Like they've come up with all these innovations. The thing that they popularized in the beginning was ephemeral posts, images mm-hmm. that disappear after 24 right. hours. Yeah. That now is on all of the major platforms everywhere is stories. It's a huge part of Instagram, less so on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, but they're everywhere. That's like Snapchat DNA all over the internet.
Right. Well, I think you touched on two really important things. And the latter is that Facebook does have a history of copying Snapchat, borrowing from them quite generously. And the other thing you touch on is, I think what you're describing as Discover, is that stories? I'm looking at the app right now as we're taping this pod. Or the spotlight tab.
I mean like discovery on the platform in general.
Oh, just discovering it. Yeah, yeah. I think they used to have this section of the app that was, I think, called Discover. Mm-hmm. This is going back some years now, where they had official partnerships with media brands and with really big stars. Like I think the Kardashians may have been a part of it. And that just sort of didn't work for them, which I think brings up important questions about where their audience goes as their current audience matures. Like at some point, Are they going to be looking for things other than maybe, you know, beauty ASMR where people are popping pimples or...
it's so bad.
It's really spammy. There's some celebrity-related stuff. Like I see something about Miley Cyrus and a weird outfit and something about the Hemsworth brothers. But then it's like, this is what happens when you stop wearing a bra, and some dance videos that are somewhat... a little bit suggestive. And then there's this weird video about like what happens when your tongue is really long, and a woman who's like making a hack out of her Victoria's Secret underwear. And then there are a lot of ads too. There's just like, you know, something, a sneaker ad I'm seeing right now, or a Zipline ad. It feels very spammy. The primary, the most impressive, oh, my nephew just sent me a snap right now. He has put an AR filter of a crow on his face. But that, I mean, that's a more joyful experience for me right now, just receiving that DM from my nephew than going through the stories or Discover.
And of course, you know, you mentioned this briefly, but the other thing we have to talk about is the lenses, right? The AR filters, which is the thing that another thing that Snapchat popularized that again got picked up everywhere else. But of course, like no matter how often companies steal from Snap, Snap still makes a lot of money. They have those active users. Those active users, as you mentioned, are very active. And they've had a couple of rough quarters lately, but things are still pretty rosy for them, right? They're still continuing to grow and they're still bringing in a lot of revenue. So they have all these innovations and they have all these daily active users and they are continuing to grow and make money. So how are they monetizing this?
Yeah, that's an important question because ultimately Snap is an advertising platform. They just reported first quarter earnings last week, and it wasn't a great quarter for them. They reported that revenue fell short of expectations, which the CEO, Evan Spiegel, said was partly because of a pullback in advertising due to the war in Ukraine. So he kind of blamed it on macroeconomic factors. Interestingly, their daily active users still went up about 18%. But revenue, the money they're making per active user, also fell short of expectations. And like a lot of other social networks, Snap has said that Apple's changes on iOS, the changes that ATT, that limit ad tracking and targeting, has impacted them. So they keep getting these new users, but they still have to figure out how to continue to make more money off of each user.
So about that growth, I have kind of a sensitive question.
Okay.
Do people age out of Snapchat?
Yeah. I would think that that's got to be a real concern for them. Yeah, because like we just said, like, I mean, we're a little bit older. We are millennial or post-millennial English majors, as we've established on this show before. but like we're going through it and we're looking at some of this content and just thinking this doesn't really appeal to us, right? And so I am wondering what they're going to do. I think that's one of the things that Facebook has been tremendously effective at. Not necessarily building new products, but acquiring new products and anticipating where people are going to go next. So buying properties like Instagram and then WhatsApp. And then Oculus, right? Like they've got a lot of eggs in their basket. Snap, you know, that like dancing hot dogs and crow filters and like bunny ears are awesome. But like I'm really curious to see what the next iteration of that technology is. And by the way, I think like I've seen glimpses of it. Like when I tested the AR glasses last year, I saw some really cool use cases for lenses. They're doing some really interesting stuff with points of interest in cities like London, where you go and there's like a sort of geotagged location specific experience where you hold up your phone and you see this really cool AR lens. Or you might be able to go to a concert in the future and like through a partnership with Live Nation, you hold up your phone at the concert and you see this really cool experience layered over the in-person concert. Like I could see where they're trying to make AR happen, but does that necessarily mean that like people much older than 34 or whatever that demographic is are going to be hooked on Snap for years to come? I'm not really sure about that. I mean, Mike, if you had to leave Twitter right now, if you did opt to leave Twitter, we already talked about how you're probably not going to migrate to Snap, but like what other social network would you opt to spend that time on?
I think it would be TikTok, because like the thing that I keep coming back to with Snapchat is that there's not really a lot there for the passive user, right? Like TikTok is like TV. You turn it on and there is literally just something for everybody. immediately, within the first 5 minutes, you can find a bunch of things that you just want to watch over and over again. You know, I don't have that experience when I open the Snapchat app. And I don't know if that's just the quality of the content that is on offer as like a user who doesn't have a lot of activity on the app. I'm sure mm-hmm. if I used it more, it may show me things that are more interesting to me. But I have been using it and I'm still not seeing much that's interesting. TikTok, on the other hand, you use it for 30 seconds and there's a bunch of stuff to look at. So
yeah,
like if I'm going to spend time like on my phone just staring at it and scrolling, which I really should stop doing, then I think that's probably the place that I would go. But also, I'm not going to quit Twitter. I've been toying with it for like last week. Oh, I'm totally going to quit Twitter. But that's just, I really just don't see that happening. What about you? Are you gonna dump Twitter and go to Snap?
Yeah, I think what I would do is I would go to one of the social networks that's not owned by a billionaire.
So Mastodon?
Right. Yeah, if you let me know what some of those options are, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, really. I don't know if there is one. I think maybe you could like download WordPress and run your own blog or something.
That's right. Back to RSS.
Never went away. All right, let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll do our recommendations.
Hey, everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Lauren, you made it all the way to the end of the show. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, in the time it took to tape this podcast, I've actually aged out of Snapchat. So
You were on it at the beginning? I mean, okay. Yeah. So tell us, what is your recommendation for our listeners this week?
My recommendation is another podcast. I just had the chance to listen to a Decoder interview with Chris Dixon. Decoder is a Verge podcast hosted by The Verge's editor-in-chief, Nalay Patel. They taped this in early April, and so I'm a little bit behind the curve on it, but I finally had the chance to listen, and it's as good as a lot of people said it was. Chris Dixon is one of the most prominent crypto and Web3 boosters out there. He's a longtime entrepreneur. He'd started a company called Hunch a long time ago. He's got his hands and his investments in a lot of different interesting technologies. I think eBay and Kickstarter, and I mean, I'm not doing it any justice, but anyway, now he's at the very well-known venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, leading their crypto team, their crypto fund. And he very rarely, I think, grants these kinds of interviews. And Nalay asked him a lot of really smart questions about Web3 and crypto and NFTs and the promise of the blockchain and the environmental toll of these emerging technologies, relatively new technologies. I shouldn't say emerging because they're pretty much out there. But it's great. It's a really good interview. I think it helps demystify some of the crypto world and the Web3 world, while Nalay, I think, also injects the appropriate amount of skepticism into the conversation.
Awesome.
So have you had the chance to listen to that one yet?
No, I have not. It has been many a moon since I've listened to the Verge's podcast, I must say.
Oh, is that because they're competitors?
No, not at all. I do enjoy a good Nalay convo, just like any other, you know, red-blooded tech reporter. It's just I have gotten into this habit lately of really checking out when I'm not like working and not mm-hmm. listening to things that remind me of work in my weekends and my evenings and my mornings and my spare time. So I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks and just like listening to the normal, you know, BS that I listen to, which is like interviews with artists and musicians and stuff.
Well, if you're into audiobooks, might I recommend the audiobook version of The Metaverse book by Matthew Ball, which is also, I'm just kidding. You clearly don't want to listen to this. I haven't read that one yet, so I'm not recommending it. I'm just making a joke. But no, I expect nothing less of you, Mike. I expect that you're like, have you heard this new, you know, about this new book from Lou Dayon or something? And I'd be like, no, tell me about this. And then
it's got four limbs and a head.
Did I say her name right? I think that's how you say it, right?
So, Doyon? Yeah.
Yes. Okay, but what is your recommendation this week?
My recommendation is Fault Radio, which is a nonprofit organization here in the Bay Area that broadcasts DJ sets and live music sets by underground electronic music artists.
Is it called Fault because it's on the fault?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we live in a seismic activity zone here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So
yes,
they chose that to name their radio station. So I am specifically recommending the YouTube channel, which does live streams. Each DJ set or like live set is usually around an hour and 15 minutes. And it's really interesting stuff. Like they have people doing techno, drum and bass, acid house, weird avant-garde music. It's a mixture of all different kinds of genres of electronic music, artists from all around the world, not just Bay Area people, but of course like heavily rostered by Bay Area people. So if you watch the YouTube streams, you can watch the video, which is just a person twiddling knobs usually and dancing a little bit, or you can just like leave it in a tab open and listen to it, which is what I do. I'd highly recommend it. They're also on SoundCloud and you can find their streams there. They post more on the YouTube channel, which is why I'm recommending the YouTube channel. But it's a vast library of really excellent electronic music. So definitely check it out if you're into like the dancey stuff. I like to work to it. I like to put it on while I'm working.
That sounds cool. I'll have to listen to it. I don't often listen to dance music while I'm working. I like more chill stuff, but it sounds like there's a wide range of genres on this channel.
It works great for deadlines, let me tell you.
Oh, is that a hint?
No.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up. I'll get back to writing.
Yes. That is our show for this week. So thank you all for listening. Lauren, thank you for being the guest this week. It was delightful to host you.
Oh, Mike, thanks for being such a great host. This was really fun. we asked so many people to join us this week and everyone was like busy. So we're like, you know what? We're going rogue. And it was a lot of fun.
Yes. We'll do this more often.
We should.
If you have feedback about the show, you can find all of us on Twitter. Just check the show notes. The show is produced by Boone Ashworth. We will be back next week, again, talking about all of the latest Twitter news with a very special guest. So join us then.
Sorry, the cat's like pawing at me again. Please continue.
Drum and bass, acid house, weird...
Weird cat mashups.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
From PRX.